Hi, I'm Brooke Taylor, the pastor of Missio Church. We exist to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ without having to come or go anywhere. Thank you so much for listening to our sermon series through the Old Testament book of Job. We are so excited about what God is teaching us about Himself, about our suffering, and about Jesus Christ through His Word. It is the prayer of the elders of Missio Church that listening to this sermon would help transform you into the image of Jesus Christ and deepen your relationship with Him. We desire that this sermon would be a supplement to your regular engagement with a local church and would not in any way replace you gathering with that church and submitting to the leaders that God has put over your life. If the elders of Missio Church can be of any assistance to you, you can contact us through our website, www.missiochurch.faith. You can also email us at admin@missiochurch.faith or by calling us 631-241-2136. If you are not a part of a local church, you can gather with us each Sunday at 10 a.m. at 70 Smith Road in Ridge, New York. We hope you enjoy today's message. As part of our Christmas gift to our older children, we like to go to the city and we like to go see a Broadway show, but we always have dinner someplace beforehand. And it seems that once we eat dinner and make it to the show, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to let the kids leave. Kids can go. They're all scared. They're like, I have to stay here the whole time? There they go.
My kids were refusing to leave.
Oh. That's... Your kids are an example to us all, Jonathan. Sorry about that. So yeah, so we like to go to the city, and we like to have dinner, and then we head over to the show. And once we get to the show, it always seems once you find your seat, you don't really want to get up and leave, because they're kind of crowded, it's hard to walk through, they're very narrow. And if you do not make it a point to go to the bathroom beforehand, it can be a very long night. And it seems like the first act is always the longest. And about an hour into that first act, after all the glasses of water or Coke Zero that I drank at dinner start to have a small effect on me. And I desperately need a bathroom break. But it is a significant faux pas to leave a Broadway show in the middle of an act or a scene. You're not supposed to do it. You are supposed to wait till the intermission. And besides, trying to climb over multiple people in that row that you are in is not easy, it's not delicate, it is not pretty. So I wait, and I watch my clock. And I keep looking to see how much longer it could be, and I'm trying to figure out where the song is at and the place of the story, and are we near the break, are we near the intermission? So that as soon as that intermission happens and the lights come up and the curtain drops, I jump out of that row and I run to the bathroom. And thankfully, this section of Job kind of feels like an intermission. It feels like the kind of time where we can sort of take a break from all the heaviness that we've been hearing, the suffering, the emotions, and even the incessant counsel, the bad counsel of his friends, seems to make things worse, not better. And Job is probably feeling frustration, and you and I are probably feeling frustration as we read it. 27 chapters of sorrow and distress and misery. So a chance to kind of catch our breath and take a break and maybe even make a run to the restroom. And to reset our thinking comes at a welcome time. It allows us to stop for a moment and to not focus on the severity of all the suffering, but instead to focus on the source of divine justice and the source of divine wisdom. Something that Job needs, something that Job's friends need, and something that each of us need desperately, whether it's in times of blessing or in times of suffering. So if you're taking notes, consider this the bathroom break of our series. A moment
to get ready for the second half. Because the second half of the show is usually the most climactic. It is usually the best. It is usually when everything is resolved and you walk out of there feeling excited. And the second half of Job is the same way. But before we get there, we need an intermission. And so this morning in our intermission, I want you to think about two things, hopefully today. And the first is that justice is not a what, but a who. And it cannot be avoided, but it will find the wicked. Justice is not a what, but a who. It cannot be avoided, and it will find the wicked. Among scholars and biblical teachers, there is some debate about who is speaking in chapters 27 and chapter 28. It's obvious that verse 1 of 27 is Job, but the second half of 27 is up for debate. And many people don't believe chapter 28 came from Job's mouth at all. Whether it came from Job or Zophar or Bildad or some other unnamed narrator is left somewhat to the mind and the mysteries of the world. And it may be impossible to know for certain. But we do know that Job begins chapter 27 because it says so. Job again took up his discourse and said. And this phrase is unique in Job because he hasn't really spoken like this up to this point. Chapter 26 was a robust praise of God, and then it just kind of stops there. And you're expecting Zophar, the third and final friend, to make his third and final speech, but Zophar says nothing. It's almost like there's a pause after 26, and Job's kind of waiting. Okay, Zophar, you want to say something? You want to come at me again? I'm ready for you. And Zophar doesn't say anything, and so then Job speaks up and breaks the silence. And he breaks the silence with another defense of his innocence. And then the middle part of chapter 27 is Job cursing his enemies and then lumping them in with the justice that is to come to the wicked. But the first six verses begin this assertion of innocence. And Job admits that he's bitter. He says he's bitter. His tone, his words are bitter. And he even accuses God of treating him unjustly, which God will rebuke him for later. And Job is being careless and he is being foolish in his speech. You know, sometimes we hear stories of police officers who will convince a suspect to confess a crime that he or she did not commit. I don't think that that's malicious. I don't think they're trying to sabotage somebody. But after hours of interrogation, it's very possible that someone might very well just say that they did something just to kind of get out from underneath the weight of the interrogation or the deliriousness of the time that they've spent. Or maybe they're told by someone, maybe an attorney, maybe a police officer, that if they confess that they'll serve less jail time or no jail time. And so there are times or occasions where people will confess a crime that they did not do and they know that they did not do. But it's only until later when DNA evidence produces an obvious indicator that they did not do this crime that they might be exonerated of their guilt. Well, Job here knows that he is righteous. He knows that he did not sin. He knows that he did not do something to deserve the suffering. And he says he will not confess to sins that he did not commit. He will not lie, because if he lies and says, listen, I'm just guilty, I confess it, he knows if he's doing that, he's lying to himself and he's lying to God. He will not confess to wickedness so that his suffering will end. And this is not surprising, because you remember back in chapter 1, God praises Job for being a person of integrity. And here, throughout all of his suffering, Job maintains that integrity. He demonstrates it. How easy is it for us when we suffer, when we go through difficulty, to kind of toss out all of our sense of morality and righteousness? Like, in other words, like it's okay that I'm doing something foolish because I'm suffering, so it's okay for me to do it. Well, Job, he's confident that God will vindicate him. He knows his conscience is clear, even though his heartache is very real. And Job would rather die than to compromise his integrity with a false confession simply to appease his friends or to avoid further suffering. That would be sin. And Job runs from sin. Job turns away from sin. But Job runs towards justice. And here is the part where it seems like, well, is Job really saying this? Because it doesn't match up what he said. In fact, it mirrors what Zophar and Bildad have said up to this point. So are they speaking, or has Job changed his mind? He calls out his enemies here. I mean, we don't know even who the enemies are. It could be his friends. They seem to be acting very enemy-like. If it is Job speaking, maybe he's calling out the Sabians and the Chaldeans, the ones that were his true enemies who attacked his home and his livelihood. But Job sees his enemies. He sees the wicked. He sees the unrighteous. He sees them getting justice from God. And this is a change from what Job said earlier. He says, no, the wicked don't seem to get justice. The evil don't seem to suffer. He sees that all of this injustice that's happening is a sign that God is unjust. But now his temperament has changed, and here he sees that the wicked will get the justice of God. And the reason that's important is because that means that Job will not retaliate against the wicked. He will not seek vengeance on his own. He will not take matters into his own hands. Instead, Job is going to look to God to judge his accusers. His words sound very similar to what's called an imprecatory prayer in the Psalms. We see David do this, in which he calls upon God's justice upon his enemies. He prays against those who are rising up against him, that their plans would fail, that they would meet justice, that they would meet their end. I mean, Job is praying that God would take the lives of his enemies. That those who don't typically call on God, that even if they did call on God, that God wouldn't hear them. And then in the last section, the longest section, Job offers instruction to his enemies. That's why it seems like in some part he's speaking to his friends, because who else would he be instructing? The Sabians are not listening. The Chaldeans don't care. And he's going to counsel them. They've been offering him counsel this whole time. Not helpful counsel, not godly counsel. They've been giving him counsel nonetheless. And so now Job turns his attention to them, and he offers them counsel. And it's interesting, it sounds almost verbatim to what Zophar said back in Job 20. You say you've seen the judgment of God and the wicked, yet why have you come together in pride to falsely accuse me? And so Job takes their theology and turns it around on them and says, this is what God will do to you for your lies. Your children will die. You will starve. You will die yourselves. Your wealth and your money and your possessions will all prove to be useless. Your home will offer no protection. Your riches will offer no security. Your dreams will haunt you, and you will be swept away in a flood of destruction. Job says that's what the wicked deserve. That is what God will do to them. That is the outcome of your life. You see, I think Job wants his human counselors to receive justice. And those who oppose God and those who oppose God's people will do well to take note of Job's prayer and to beware, because there is a certainty and a recognition that Job is beginning to see that God's justice will actually come to the wicked. And so if you are on the side of the righteous, if you are on the side of Yahweh, then that's good news for the oppression that you might be facing, for the difficulty that you might be undergoing. But if you are in opposition to God, if you are in opposition to His righteousness, then that is really bad news for you. But, you know, those who fear and trust God should also be cautiously aware of this as well. Because ultimately, at the end of this story, God will treat the three friends much better than what Job prays for. Job wants them dead. God restores them. Job wants them to meet justice. God shows them mercy. You see, Job in his suffering let his anger lead him to condemn his friends. In a sense, the grace that Job wants for himself, he is not willing to show to his friends. And how often we can do the same. We can want grace from everybody. Be patient with me. God's still working on me. Be patient with me. I make a lot of mistakes. It's not always my fault. I don't intend to do it. Sometimes you misunderstand me. But then when we're on the other side of the equation, how quick we are to judge. Oh no, you were vindictive. Oh no, you were mean. Oh no, you were... And we cast judgment and we accuse. Just like Job. We want someone dead. We want them to face justice. But that's not the heart of God, right? The heart of God is that all should be saved. The heart of God is that He wants to be benevolent and merciful to any sinner who comes to Him can find mercy and grace. Sometimes our calls for justice, we can put them under a fake veil of righteousness and divine authorization, but in reality, our calls for justice are nothing more than personal vindication and vengeance. It's the opposite of God's will. You might even say that it is anti-Christ. Justice. It's not a what. It's a who. It is Yahweh. And it cannot be avoided. It will find the wicked. But second, we see that wisdom is not a what, but a who. And it cannot be found, but it will find you. Wisdom is not a what, but a who. It cannot be found, but it will find you. Again, chapter 28, most scholars have a hard time accepting that these are the words of Job. And maybe it matters, maybe it doesn't. On the one hand, the topic and the language might make us surmise that this chapter contains the narrator's voice. Almost like a director of a play who stops the drama and comes down from the production booth and addresses the cast members or even the audience, speaking with a voice of serenity and tranquility and scientific objectivity. He reminds both the audience and the actors of the path that Job and his friends need to take in order to arrive at the desired destination of answers. They need wisdom. They think that they're offering wisdom. They think they're counseling Job with wisdom. Job thinks he has wisdom. And the narrator is saying, no, none of you guys are really wise. Whether or not it's from Job or the narrator, it does feel like an interlude. It pauses the narrative. But it speaks to Job's problem. Job needs wisdom. And he's gotten everything but wisdom from his friends. And so, like chapter 27, it's broken down into three sections. Verses 1 to 11 is the opening section. And like a good preacher, the speaker opens with an illustration. My illustration was about going to the bathroom. His is about mining precious jewels. The author of Job is probably a better preacher. He describes the ingenuity and the determination that humans display in mining precious stones and minerals. Mining is a dangerous and costly endeavor today. You can imagine what it was in 2000 BC. Mining, though, has always been difficult. It's always been demanding. It's always been dangerous. Minerals have to be found. You have to dig them. You have to discover them. You have to dig deep. They're not typically just sitting on the surface saying, hey, come take me out of the rock. I'm a perfectly crafted 8-carat diamond. No, you've got to find it. Shafts are sunk deep below the surface. Humanity goes down into the earth. They go down into the very caverns of what typically would be death. And they go down willingly. And you can imagine the number of people that don't come out. Even today, you hear of mines collapsing and people getting stuck and people suffocating in the depths of a mine. In Germany, one of the highlights when you visit Germany is to visit the salt mines of Salzburg. And you go down in these mines with you ride this little toy train that you think, how on earth are we going to even survive this? And you go down hundreds and hundreds of feet into the depths. And once you're down there, they actually have slides in the mines to expedite them getting from one level to the next, wooden slides that you ride down with leather like coverings on your backside. You don't get a splinter. Right? That would hurt. Get to the bottom and go, can someone please get a tweezer and pluck the splinter out of my rear? Like, I don't think that's part of the paid admission. And you go down hundreds and hundreds of feet. It's dark. There's not a lot of light. And while you're down there, like, there's a part of you, you're like, I'm going to die down here. I'm not going to get out of this place. You have to dig a shaft. You have to drop and lower people into those shafts. And then you have to use fire to make the rock yield its treasure. You have to refine that rock once it is harvested. And the writer of Job is just marveling at the astonishing things that mankind can do. He says, birds are majestic. They fly and they see everything, but no bird is wearing a ruby necklace. Falcons can see so far away. The beasts of the land are powerful. Lions, the king of the jungle, but none of them is wearing a diamond charm bracelet. No, man alone sees those things. Man alone sees the potential. Man alone discovers it. Man alone digs it. Man alone harvests it, uses it. Mankind has a unique power over creation that animals do not have. We have the ability to bring light to the hidden things. And why is that? Because we're made in God's image. And God is the one that brought light into existence. He is the one that brings light to the hidden things of our heart. And in a way, we are mimicking and mirroring the creative power and the majesty of God as we discover all these things. And this is quite a different reflection than what Bildad said in chapter 25. You remember, he said that we're all a bunch of maggots. But maggots can't mine the earth. We are God's crowning creation. And that's why ultimately we remember that as great as animals are, and as majestic as they are, and as much joy as they can give us, that they don't compare to people. We're not like on equal playing fields of worth and value. His opening illustration just says, this is what mankind can do. But verse 12 to 19, it begins this song, this hymn of wisdom. And it basically says that even though we are creative and have resiliency and have immense ingenuity, mankind cannot find wisdom. It's not as easy to find wisdom as precious jewels. And it's not easy to find precious jewels. Wisdom is inaccessible to humanity. It's not found just on the land, just lingering about. It's not even buried in the caverns and caves like gold. You can't find wisdom at the bottom of a sea. And not only that, silver and gold, these things that are so valuable to us, the things that we spend all this time and energy trying to mine, the things that have value and worth, we can't buy wisdom with it. And that's evident by some of the foolish things that the wealthy do, right? They have a lot of money and they have no wisdom. We can buy all kinds of things with gold and silver, homes and cars and boats and even a college education. But you cannot buy wisdom. And this flies in the face of modern thinking because the idea is that wisdom can be mastered through education. That those who have the most degrees have the most wisdom. But as we're reminded in our house, C's get degrees, and I'm not sure if the people that get the C's are the wisest people in the world. We think that wisdom can be controlled by wealth, or that it's only had by the powerful. But sometimes the people that have the money didn't earn it. Sometimes the people that have the power didn't deserve it. Compared to all the precious jewels that are so valuable to us, diamonds and rubies and gold and pearls. I mean, if we could find that tomorrow, if we could just, you know, go into our kitchen like a friend of ours did years ago. They were doing a rehab in their kitchen, and they start tearing out the old cabinets, and they discovered a hidden drawer, and in that hidden drawer dropped just thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of jewelry that somebody had long since buried in their kitchen and forgot it was there. Like, I mean, isn't that your dream? Like, to go in your house and just pull up the floorboard and find stockpiles of money? I mean, you don't even care where it came from. It could be drug money. You don't care. You just are glad to find it. Wisdom is more power, more valuable than all of that. But if we were honest, most of us, we don't think of it that way. We don't think of wisdom as being valuable because we teach our kids and we teach our grandkids, no, make the most money, make the most money, make the most money, because that's where value is. Get a degree, get a master's degree, get a doctorate, get a PhD, do those things. That's what we value. We value the wrong things because wisdom is worth more than those things. And while humans above all creatures can probe the mysteries of the earthly domain, we cannot probe the mysteries of the heavenly domain. We can scratch out of hidden rocks the most beautiful treasures, but we cannot scratch the surface of wisdom. We can bring to light all the hidden material things, but we cannot unearth the wisdom. And therein lies our problem. In times of blessing, in times of suffering, in times of victory, in times of failure, we don't know where to find wisdom. If wisdom is so elusive, if what Job needs is wisdom, if what his friends need are wisdom, if what we need is wisdom, where do we find wisdom? Where does it come from? If it cannot be dug up, if we can't discover it, then wisdom must find us. And up until now, Job has found little wisdom from his friends. Everything that's been given to him has been finite sentiments. But wisdom is not accessible to birds or animals. It is hidden from the eyes of all the living, including his three friends. Eliphaz thinks he has wisdom in his mystical experience. Bildad thinks he has wisdom in lofty theology. Zophar thinks he has wisdom in common sense. But they are all devoid of wisdom. Job needs something not human. Job needs something outside of himself. Job needs something outside of creation. And so finally, after mining through 22 verses, the writer of Job finally reaches an answer to the question, where can wisdom be found? Where does the search for wisdom end? Verse 23 says, God understands the way to it. He knows its place. God knows where wisdom is. He alone can see everything. He alone is omniscient. He alone governs the affairs of the world. He made it all. And God's power demonstrated in the world is wisdom. The point of chapter 28 is, if Job cannot find wisdom in his own experience or from the meager attempts of his friends, Job must go directly to God, because God alone has understanding. That is why chapter 28 changes the focus for the rest of the book. You see, the rest of the book is no longer a quest to understand why Job is suffering. The quest of the book is to understand who God is. He says at the end of 28, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. To turn away from evil, that is wisdom." We see the same point made in Proverbs 1 and Ecclesiastes 12. Like gold and diamond, wisdom starts out hidden from view. It is concealed treasure, but God knows where to find it, and God reveals it to people. Wisdom is with God. And it is only through a proper attitude of submission and respect and dependence and worship of the one true God, of Yahweh, and obedience to His ways that anyone can find wisdom. The fear of the Lord. This explains why Job and his friends have not found their search close. This is why they've strived but have not gotten close enough. They have strayed from the path of wisdom entirely. They have searched for it in the wrong way, in the wrong places. They have relied on experience and observation and feelings. But to find wisdom, one must learn to fear God, to turn away from evil. In an amazing way, in chapter 28, God's wisdom is paradoxically inaccessible to us, and yet available to us. After this chapter, we no longer hear from Job's friends. I hope they are sitting and listening to all that will take place. But these chapters are a transition, and Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, the ones who have been devoid of godly wisdom, are now left in the shadows, and Job's search for true wisdom begins. And yet, even as Job does not know wisdom yet to its fullest, we get a glimpse, even from chapter 1, how close Job is. And I think this is the danger for all of us, is how close we can be to wisdom and not have it. Because Job, in chapters 1 and 2, God says about Job, "Have you considered Job my servant? There is none like him in all the earth. He's a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Job is not wicked. He is not evil. Despite what his friends say, Job has wisdom. But he does not tap into the wisdom that is there. He fears God and he shuns evil. But he's not looking to God alone for answers. Job's search will only reach its conclusion not by searching for answers, but by searching for God himself. And this ultimately is the purpose of the book, to teach Job, to teach us, where is our real treasure? Is it in what we have? Is it in what we have lost? Is it what we long for on this earth? Or is it found in Yahweh? In a sense, chapter 28 does feel out of place. But in God's providence, it's right where it needs to be. A hymn of wisdom demonstrating spiritual growth and steadfastness. Job trusts God. Job fears God. Job turns from evil. He already has found what he needs. Or rather, what he needs has already found him. You know, as much as Job feared God and turned from evil, Jesus Christ was the perfect Son of God who feared God like no one ever has, enduring the incarnation and lowering himself setting aside his own glory, taking on the cross and death. Jesus feared God, but Jesus also loved righteousness and hated sin like no other. He never once succumbed to the temptation of sin. He suffered and was tempted in every way that we are, yet without sin. And Job, who ultimately let his anger lead him to condemn his friends, Jesus prayed for his friends in that upper room, knowing full well that they would make foolish choices and sinful actions, and that they would even deny his very existence. Even on the cross, as the enemies of God are crucifying Jesus, Jesus let his mercy lead him to show grace. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Offering sinners, including ourselves, much more than we deserve or ever thought possible. Jesus Christ crucified, 1 Corinthians tells us, is a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Gentiles, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. The wisdom of God that we seek is Jesus. The power of God that we need in our lives is Jesus. Job sought wisdom from his friends, but thankfully, when we go through suffering and grief, while human counselors and encouragers can be helpful, we don't need to depend upon them, because Isaiah 9:6 says the long-awaited Messiah is a better counselor, because he is God. He is wisdom incarnate. He is an infallible guide through life. He is not just the source of infinite wisdom. He is wisdom. Colossians 2:3 says, in Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. If you want to know wisdom, then you seek the one who has already found you. He is the treasure of God's infinite wisdom. And the thing that is most exciting is that what we've learned in our study is that we have only begun to scratch the surface of the infinite majesty of Jesus Christ. We'll be studying who Jesus is for the rest of eternity. We will be gaining wisdom forever. That's how infinite his treasure is. Jesus has given us his example to lead us. He has given us his spirit to indwell and empower us. He has given us his word to guide us. Praise God for our wonderful counselor, the Prince of Peace, wisdom. The wisdom that God provides in Jesus is not just about answers for life. It is not just about comfort. It is about resurrection. The gift of Jesus is for your salvation, so that the justice that you do deserve, the justice that ultimately will be handed out, will instead be received by you as nothing more than mercy, because the wise one will undertake what you deserve. And so, do you seek to know him? Do you seek to plumb the depths of his life? Is he your hope in life and death? Is he your source of wisdom? He is the only one who can make sense of the ups and downs of life, the only one who can bring justice, the only one who can save. You know, some of you might be in spiritual danger today because the promise of Job that judgment is coming for the wicked is true of you. That God's judgment is coming for you. You see, the wicked will stand before God arrogant in their own self-righteousness and good works and discover God's wrath is swift and full and just. But if you stand before God humbled and trusting by faith in the righteousness of Jesus, in his crucifixion and resurrection for you, in the salvation that he offers to you, you will be justified. You will be vindicated. You will be forgiven, and you will find that life on the other side of that doorway is good. Have you trusted in him? Are you praising God that Jesus shows you more kindness and grace than Job ever showed his friends? and that you ever show to others? Have you believed in the gracious, wise King? You know, some of you, you might read Job's assertions of innocence and think that's exactly your problem too, that you're innocent. And what's happening to you in your life from the hand of God is unjust. And you are stepping towards bitterness towards God. You know, Job is not saying that he is righteous in all things. We know he's not righteous in all things. We hear at the beginning how he offered sacrifices for him and his children. He knows he is not righteous. But he knows he is righteous in relation to this. He knows that he has faith and trust in God. He knows that he has turned away from evil. And he knows that when he does sin, that his Father forgives him. This is the evidence of his faith. And 1 John tells you to walk in the light as he is in the light, to confess your sins, to trust God's mercy, and to turn away from evil yourselves. Job has a clear conscience because he confesses sins, not because he's perfect. I wonder if you have a clear conscience because you are regularly confessing honestly and soberly your sins. Are you resting in God's mercy? Are you trusting in his grace? Are you relying upon his power to purify you? You might not be innocent in all your ways, but through the blood of Jesus, God sees you as innocent. And that is all the righteousness and innocence you will ever need. Some of you, you're all too eager not just to want justice, but to demand or seek justice on your own. Maybe you want to get it with your fists or your words. It's okay to cry out for God's justice against those who wrong you. In fact, it's a biblical thing. It's a nonviolent way for you to remember that justice will be handed down ultimately, and a protective way for you to remember not to seek it yourself, but to trust God and his purposes and his vindication. You don't need to seek your own justice on social media, in a cubicle, or on the ball field. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. But it's not just about hoping that those who have wronged you will get what they deserve. It's about recognizing that God ultimately can forgive and restore the most foolish and wicked people. It's a reminder that you can both simultaneously ask for God's justice and seek to forgive and restore those who have wronged you. Because either way, you will find that they will receive justice on the day of judgment, or their sins will be covered by the justice poured out on Jesus. Justice every which way you look. Some of you say that you believe in God and love God and trust God and have faith in God, but you don't fear him. You don't listen to his words to turn away from evil, to walk in righteousness, to love your neighbor. There is a way that seems right to even us as Christians that can look moral and righteous and good and better than the rest of the world that is still far short of what God wants and is still outside of God's kindness and grace. Fearing God recognizes his grandeur and greatness, yes. Not only in creating the universe, but in creating you. You are his. And he has full reign and authority over your life. Turning from evil recognizes that. It recognizes God's grandeur. It also recognizes that sin is real and that sin violates God's standards and sin deserves God's justice. Why would you, who say you love God the most, walk headlong into unrighteousness? Are you more like Job's friends, religious, culturally wise, arrogant, and spiritually dumb? Or are you more like Jesus, fearing God, turning from evil, full of integrity, being who God made you to be? And then lastly, some of you are searching for all kinds of things in this life. Success, power, security, wealth, love, and knowledge. And you might think that all of those things will make you wise and give you confidence and security. Maybe you're wasting your life chasing all kinds of things that are worth far less than the priceless wisdom of God. It's the wisdom of God that provides the solid foundation when the troubles of life crash upon you, not money. It's the wisdom of God that provides security when all of life seems to be in upheaval, not knowledge. It's the wisdom of Christ that securely brings you to the other side and protects you to the evils of this world, not power. Wisdom may not provide an answer to every question that you have, but it will give you the peace to live in those moments. Do you want to be ready for trials? Learn to fear the Lord today. Do you want to be ready for the difficult times? Learn to turn away from sin today. That is wisdom. Fear and walking in righteousness. It's a right relationship with God. And some of you might have degrees and straight A's or even a commendation from a local civic authority, but you lack wisdom. Some of you have barely graduated from high school. You can barely read, or you're the last person anyone thinks of as smart. But you fear the Lord. You turn from sin. You are wise. You know, in 1715, a Spanish treasure fleet of about a dozen ships were destroyed by a hurricane off the coast of Florida. Everything on board, including the millions of dollars of wealth, was thought to be lost. But in October of 2004, Joel Ruth was walking on a Florida beach, and he just happened to come across 180 mint condition silver coins worth more than $40,000. For 289 years, that treasure had been sunk at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And then Hurricane Jean momentarily uncovered a portion of the treasure when the storm altered the shoreline and caused the once thought lost treasure to wash ashore, where an unsuspecting beachwalker stumbled upon immense wealth. Sometimes storms can do that. Storms can reveal hidden treasure. And oftentimes, God will allow the storms of our lives to lead us to discover hidden spiritual treasure that we didn't even think was possible. Spiritual wisdom. And if we are willing, if we are ready to look, we will discover in our times of suffering that there are things that are more valuable than mint condition coins. So let us be ready for the trials that come in the future. Let us confess sin today. Let us trust God's justice today. Let us fear God today. And let us learn to walk away from sin toward the newness of life that God has for us in Jesus. The world might not think of us as smart or intelligent or wise, but the one who made the universe has come to us and declared us to be justified, to be his children, to be saved by his grace, blessing us with more than who he is, transforming us into the image of his very Son. Foolishness to the world, but the wisdom of God. Our search for justice and righteousness and wisdom can only be satisfied in Jesus. But when we know him, wisdom himself, we may not have all the answers to all of life's questions, but we will have all the answers that really matter. And in times of difficulty, that is good news.